I'm Lisa Morgan, Saturday afternoon host and co-host of The Weekly Reader here on WYPR. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make live streams like this one difficult to maintain. Stand up for public media and help fortify WYPR's future. Find out more and donate at WYPR.org. And thanks.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I hope you had a good weekend. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today. Today, it's the Midday Health Watch with former Baltimore City Health Commissioner and Washington Post columnist Dr. Lena Wen. The U.S. is dropping its recommendations for routine COVID boosters for healthy children and pregnant women, a move by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., which circumvented the CDC's traditional process for public health guidance. Plus, HHS has changed the way vaccines are tested. Secretary Kennedy has long voiced skepticism of vaccinations. Yesterday, the head of the FDA, Dr. Marty Makary, called the Independent Vaccine Advisory Panel a, quote, kangaroo court. On Thursday, the CDC reported that the year-to-date total of pediatric deaths from the flu has risen to 235. That's the worst death toll for children from the flu since 2009. Baltimore has a new health commissioner. Mayor Brandon Scott announced last week that Dr. Michelle Taylor, a pediatrician who directs the Shelby County, Tennessee Health Department, will take the reins of the Baltimore Health Department on August 4th. As we do every Monday for the Midday Health Watch, we turn to Dr. Lena Wen. She's a former health commissioner of Baltimore, a columnist for The Washington Post, and the author of Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Dr. Wen joins us on Zoom. You are welcome to join us as well. Our number here at Midday, if you have a question for Dr. Wen, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Lena, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for your time.
Of course. Great to join you as always, Tom. Thank you.
So what's your advice for Dr. Michelle Taylor, who's going to take over the health department that you once led? She starts in August. What are your words of wisdom for her?
Well, I don't know Dr. Taylor, but she seems extremely qualified. I think it's great that we have someone with Baltimore ties. I believe she attended the Bloomberg School of Public Health for her her doctorate in public health. She also is currently a health director. So I'm glad that we have a permanent health director, health commissioner going forward. My advice for her is to recognize, of course, that there are many health challenges that we face in the city. But we also have a long history of innovation. We also have dedicated public servants. I was really proud to serve with so many incredible people who still work at the Baltimore City Health Department. And so she should use the expertise of the staff who are there, listen to them, but also know that she is expected to set a vision for health in the city and to respond to its many pressing needs.
There have been some backslides from some progress that you made during your tenure as health commissioner when it came to sexually transmitted infections, infant and maternal health disparities continue. So there are certainly some challenges. The number of opioid deaths from fentanyl, et cetera, has gone down, but it's still very serious. So she'll have a lot on her plate, as anybody in that position would. And when she begins in August, we'll certainly have her here on Midday so listeners can get to know her a little bit. I want to ask you, Dr. Wen, about measles. CBS News had a report a couple of days ago that the CDC has received reports of at least 62 travelers who were contagious with measles while they were flying. So if you're on an airplane with them or even in the terminal with them, you might be subject to exposure. Where do things stand nationally and here in Maryland when it comes to the measles virus and the way it's spreading?
Well, we have one of the worst outbreaks in recent history, at least, the one that originated in Texas, that has led to more cases than any other single outbreak in the last 30 years. That it looks like the number of cases might be slowing down a bit, but it's still nowhere near being under control. And the issue, as we've talked about before, Tom, is that measles is one of the most contagious diseases in the world. It is airborne, and studies have shown that 9 out of 10 unvaccinated people people, if they're exposed to measles, will contract it, that the virus particles can linger in the air for up to 2 hours, and someone can still be potentially be exposed to it and contract measles if they, even if somebody leaves the room who's infected a couple of hours before. The good news, of course, is that we have a very effective vaccine. Two doses of the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, is 97% effective against infection. And so I would say that people should verify their vaccination status. If they've had measles before, or if they were born at a time when measles was very prevalent, they are considered to have immunity. But if people have only had one dose of the measles vaccine, they might consider getting a second dose, especially if they're going to be traveling, if they're going to be going to areas where there are measles outbreaks as well.
If you're one of those people that might be vulnerable, if you don't have immunity for one of the reasons you just stated, would, for example, wearing a mask while you're traveling, while you're in an airport or on a plane, protect you? Or are there any other things you can do short of what you've just suggested?
I think that masking is certainly a good idea, because not only does it prevent infection from measles, but also other respiratory illnesses as well. But I would still say that in the case of individuals who can receive the vaccine, but who are not fully vaccinated, that really getting the second dose of the MMR vaccine is a good idea.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is with us. It's the Midday Health Watch, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So, Lena, as a scientist, as a researcher, you're with the Brookings Institution, and you teach at George Washington University, and as a former health director, what does the fact that the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, is going to be subject to some pretty severe budget cuts in the budget in brief document that the president submitted to Congress? He's saying that NIH should reduce its budget by about 40% to $18 billion. The current level is nearly $28 billion. So when you take almost $10 billion away from the NIH, what does that mean in real terms? What does that mean in terms of, you know, the future of scientific research as people in your business know it?
Well, what I would say, Tom, is I have not ever talked to a scientist who says that we should have less investment in science. I've never spoken to a physician or anyone working in the medical profession who said we should have fewer treatments and we should stop pursuing innovations because we want our patients to suffer. And similarly, I've never talked to a patient or a family member who said we don't want to find the cure or treatments for whatever ailment I have. I mean, we're at this point in history where we have incredible scientific innovations. We have more tools at our disposal than ever before. To see us as a country taking a step back and saying we don't want to pursue these potential areas for innovation, I really don't understand it. And I think it could set back progress for medical care, for certainly for the patients who are enrolled in clinical trials who have to stop now, but also just medical care in the future. Why would we want to take a step back when that is really not what anyone that I've ever spoken to in science or medicine as a practitioner or as a patient wants?
What about the fact, as many people have predicted or speculated or worried about scientists from other countries no longer wanting to work in the United States because of the attitude of the current administration about scientific research? We've got a head of Health and Human Services that's very skeptical of a lot of science. He's also told Congress that he's likely to prohibit scientists for the CDC from publishing in some of the standard journals, Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, that kind of thing. Do you have any understanding as to why Secretary Kennedy would want to do that? And what is that, in fact, going to have a chilling effect on other people wanting to work in the American scientific community?
We are already seeing, Tom, that scientists, and not just international scientists, but American scientists are leaving. We're seeing that there is an increase in scientists, and I should mention doctors too, who are going to Canada, who are going to countries in Europe, which represents a significant problem when it comes to brain drain and the workforce here, here in the US. But as to your other question of why it would be that Secretary Kennedy would ban, or is saying that he's going to ban scientists who work in the federal government from publishing in premier scientific journals. I really just don't know, Tom. The scientific journals that are being referenced, things like the New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, I mean, these are the gold standard for publications. And I suppose one could say that that Kennedy in the past has turned to, shall we say, alternative publications for research, but that also invokes a lot of fear because I think at some point there needs to be recognition of what is good science. And part of that recognition also is in which journals that research is being published. And to see that we now cannot agree on a standard of science or on which journals are the gold standard for citations, that's a significant problem.
And speaking of citations, Secretary Kennedy himself released a report called the Make America Healthy Again report. It was a commission by the Trump administration to look into why chronic illnesses are occurring, what the causes behind them are. Secretary Kennedy talked about it as the gold standard of science. He referenced many times the fact that there are 500 different citations in this 73-page report, and it turns out that at least a couple of them are sites that don't exist. They refer to studies that were fabricated one way or the other, or mistakenly identified because they don't exist in the real world. So we've got sloppiness in that regard, and then a distrust of some of these, as you say, gold standard publications. So it's really it's very concerning. What do you make of these new CDC recommendations about who should and who should not get the COVID vaccine? We're talking about pregnant women and children now no longer recommended to be vaccinated. What do you make of that?
Well, there are actually two things that have happened. And I think understanding both of them is important to try to make heads or tails of what is going on. So first is what happened with the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. Last week, the FDA said that they will restrict approval for the fall boosters. So they're saying people 65 and older, or people with chronic medical conditions who are at risk for higher, for more severe illness due to COVID, they're still able to get boosters this coming year, which I think is good. There was some concern that maybe boosters are not going to be available for anyone this fall. So I think it's good that at least people who are very vulnerable to severe illness will still be able to get boosters. But the approval is going to be restricted for healthy children or younger adults. So that's the first part. Then separately, the CDC has said that, and actually, here the CDC seems to be contradicting what Kennedy said. Kennedy said that vaccines, that COVID vaccines will no longer be recommended for children and for pregnant women. But the CDC has since said that there's going to be shared decision making for vaccines, for COVID vaccines, for healthy children. And they removed the recommendation for pregnant women. All of this is to say that this is really confusing. It's hard for me to even explain this. And I also think that we should expect changes to come, especially because there seem to be contradictions between what Secretary Kennedy is saying and what the CDC and FDA are doing. If there is this confusion among experts trying to understand it, there's going to be confusion among providers. And there certainly will be confusion in patients and also in understanding what the implications are going to be, not only for access, but also for insurance coverage. So expect a lot more in the space coming up. I would say for now that, of course, I do not agree. I think that in general, we should be preserving access. We should be giving people the option to protect themselves. We can tailor the recommendations to more strongly recommend these vaccines for people who are at higher risk, but we should not deny individuals who want protection the opportunity to get it.
When you talk about shared decision making, what does that mean exactly?
Well, generally, it refers to there not being a recommendation from the federal government, but that people are encouraged to discuss with their individual provider about whether a particular treatment or therapy is good for them. When it comes to vaccines, I suppose what that would sound like is instead of the pediatrician saying, you should be getting these vaccines, instead the patient goes to the physician, they have a conversation, and they decide whether the vaccine is recommended. Now, all of this sounds reasonable. The problem, though, is that if a vaccine is not recommended by the CDC, it does not compel insurance companies to cover it. And so the concern here is that might the COVID vaccine, especially for groups that may be more vulnerable, if it becomes part of shared decision making, perhaps many people will opt not to get it because they cannot afford the price tag.
And when it comes to a physician making a recommendation, isn't it the case that a physician would look to the CDC, as at least one of the sources that she might consult when it comes to deciding whether or not, to suggest this for her patients?
Absolutely. And I would say that that's another issue that I've been hearing from my colleagues in medicine and public health, that people are concerned that the CDC may no longer be the gold standard that we've always held it to. As in right now, we know that there are extraordinary public servants, of course, who work at the CDC, but we're also hearing that many of these experts have been let go, and also that other experts have been compelled to put things on the website, for example, that they may not agree with. And so right now, I think that much of the information on the CDC website still remains the same compared to before, but we are seeing now other organizations step up into the void. Medical organizations, for example, are publishing more on their own. We're also seeing several other consortia of scientists get together and publish their own recommendations regarding vaccines in preparation for the point where the CDC may no longer be the trusted voice. And that will really be a sad day for not just the US, but for countries around the world, many of whom have called their premier entity in health, the CDC, European CDC, or other countries, African CDC, in recognition of the CDC being the gold standard, but it may no longer be.
And this, of course, all takes place in the context of the fact that the World Health Organization has warned that there's a new variant of COVID, and we've dealt with, you and I have talked about variants for the last 5 years now, that there's a new variant of COVID that is driving up the number of cases, not in the United States, but in other places around the globe. What can you tell us about that?
I would simply say that this is to be expected. We will expect to have new variants forevermore. As long as COVID is with us, we expect that this is now endemic and we are going to be living with this coronavirus for really the rest of our lives. As long as that's the case, we are going to have new variants. And the key here is to see, is the variant causing more severe illness? It does not appear to be the case. Does it appear to be even more contagious? Probably not. Or even if it is more contagious, COVID is already extremely contagious. And then also, do our current vaccines still cover it? And I think that remains to be seen. But this is another reason why constant monitoring and extreme vigilance by scientists is so important. We cannot afford to cut back on the science and on monitoring for variants because we need to know as soon as these variants appear and as soon as they appear to be causing outbreaks in other parts of the world as to whether our existing vaccines work. And if not, then we should be making new updated vaccines.
Dr. Lena Wen is a former health commissioner of Baltimore. She's a columnist on health matters for the Washington Post, a medical expert at CNN, and a scholar at George Washington University and the Brookings Institution. We'll have more with Dr. Wen on the other side of a quick break. You can join us. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, it's Midday on Sports. WYPR's resident sports aficionado Gabe Ortiz will join me. We'll talk about Orioles baseball, Ravens football. We might touch on the NBA, the WNBA, even the NHL. Who knows? Danielle Allen Tuck and Kyle Goon of the Baltimore Banner will join us as well. So Midday on Sports, I hope you'll join the conversation tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, I'm speaking with Dr. Lena Wen. Dr. Wen is a former health commissioner for Baltimore City, a columnist for The Washington Post, a medical expert at CNN, and a scholar at George Washington University and the Brookings Institution. She joins us on Zoom. You can join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org. So, Lena, you wrote about the new way or a new approach to testing vaccines that Secretary Kennedy, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, has announced. And this is using a placebo to test vaccines. We hear about placebo testing in all sorts of medical trials and scientific experiments. What's going on? What have we done in the past? What are they suggesting we do in the future?
Well, I think it's important to point out that placebo testing has been what has been used throughout history in the past when it comes to vaccines, as it has been for other therapies. And so here, I think that Secretary Kennedy's comments are misleading, because he has been suggesting that this is something that has not been done, when in fact, you think back to the polio vaccine field trials in 1954, more than 620,000 children were randomly assigned to either get the vaccine or placebo. And since then, every time a vaccine against a disease to which no previous immunization existed, all the trials have started with placebo-controlled trials. That includes measles, rotavirus, shingles, RSV, COVID, HPV, pneumococcus. I mean, we can name dozens of other trials that all used placebo versus the vaccine. The situation, though, is that there are two cases that allow for vaccine testing without a placebo. The first case is when an effective vaccine already exists and manufacturers are looking to improve its formulation. The reason to not use a placebo in those cases is about ethics, because you wonder, well, how can scientists really justify withholding something that's effective and knowingly expose the study population to disease? The second instance where placebo testing isn't routinely used is for strain changes. So every year, for example, we're used to getting an updated vaccine against the flu. Every year, the only thing that's changed in the formulation is the strain of the virus to which that vaccine targets. So nothing else has changed, it's just the strain. If you did placebo testing every single time, you would be into the next season, and it would actually be too late by the time you get this new vaccine out. And so that's the reason why placebo testing is not done. And so I think that the concern here is, what exactly does Secretary Kennedy mean that he wants placebo testing for all vaccines, when in fact it is already what's been done for vaccines against new illnesses? Could this be another way of restricting access to COVID vaccines or to other vaccines that Kennedy seems not to approve?
We have an email from a listener, Daniel, who says, and this is a tough question for you, Lena, but I'm going to pass it along just to see what you say. Can a list of the new, more trusted medical websites be made available? I trust Dr. Wen, and I need to know who she recommends. That's a very broad question, but if, in fact, you know, the CDC is no longer the gold standard or headed in that direction. We should mention, for example, that the CDC's Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices usually meets and votes on changes to immunization recommendations. And this recommendation to withdraw the recommendation for healthy children and pregnant women about the COVID vaccine is not something that this Committee for Immunization Practices met on and voted on. Usually they vote on it, they make a recommendation to the director of the CDC, and that person makes the final call. So again, if people are distrustful or wary of what we're hearing from the CDC, where do you recommend they look?
That's a terrific question. And actually, I've been thinking about writing on this topic. So I thank our listener for perhaps giving more impetus to a future column on exactly this topic. But in the meantime, let me give you three sources that I find to be especially helpful. Actually, I'll give you more than three. It seems like this article is writing itself already. But the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics are great resources. They have really been stepping up the resources that they've been putting online regarding vaccines. The University of Minnesota, and in particular, there's a center that's run by Dr. Michael Osterholm there. They just started a project called the Vaccine Integrity Project. They are also putting a lot of research online and analysis, especially in response to recent controversy or recent issues as raised by the Department of Health and Human Services, to which they may disagree. For specific issues, you may also want to look at resources such as ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, if individuals are concerned, for example, about vaccines and safety in pregnancy. The Infectious Disease Society of America also has helpful resources that I think would be useful. And I should also mention that all of these entities provided information that was based on the CDC before. So there really was no daylight between these entities and each other, or these entities and the CDC before. So I think to me, these are entities that could be trusted, and I think they would agree that they would rather not be doing these efforts, but are having to do so, given the issues that we're seeing on at the federal government level.
Well, that's a terrific list right off the top of your head. So that's great, and we look forward to that column that you write if you get to that. I mean, that's really a very important topic, and I appreciate the email from Daniel. I want to go back to measles on behalf of a caller who says, "I had measles many decades ago. Do I still have immunity?" So, Lena, you and I have talked about this before, but I think it's really important to remind folks who's immune and who's not. If in fact they had measles in the 50s or 60s or 70s or 80s.
If someone has ever had measles, they are concerned, they are considered to have lifelong immunity. And so these individuals do not need to get an extra dose of the MMR vaccine. They should consider themselves to be protected against measles. Now, is there still a small chance that they could have measles, that they could contract measles? Sure, but they are considered to have really exceptional protection against infection. Now, I also, if people have had two doses of the MMR vaccine, they do not need to have a third dose. People who were born before 1974 or at or before 1974, they are presumed to have immunity because measles was so prevalent in that time. If though they're still concerned, they could check the antibody titers to see if they have immunity against measles. But again, measles is considered to be quite prevalent. Prior to that, these individuals are considered to have presumed immunity. Those who were born 1958 to 1967 or thereabout, these individuals might have received a previous version of the vaccine that's less effective. So those individuals, if they are concerned, could consider receiving a one dose of the MMR vaccine. And again, individuals who may have received one dose of the MMR vaccine could consider getting a second dose, especially if they are perceived to be at higher risk, for example, if they're healthcare workers or if they plan on doing a lot of travel.
410-662-8780. That's our number here in the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. Our email, midday@wypr.org. So, Lena, I want to ask you about another topic we've discussed on many occasions in recent months, and that's the bird flu, the avian flu. There is an mRNA contract with Moderna, which worked on the COVID, one of the companies that worked on the COVID vaccine, that was developing a vaccine for bird flu, and the Trump administration has canceled it. What do you make of that? We had one writer, Jonathan Cohn, writing in the Bulwark, that said, "Imagine being handed the ultimate weapon to win a future war and throwing the weapon away." What do you think?
Yeah, basically that's it. I think that's well said. I'm not sure I have too much more to add to this, except I'll, let me maybe perhaps expand as to why this is the ultimate so-called weapon. When you look at the existing vaccine platforms that are being used to develop vaccines against bird flu, they are platforms that have been around for decades. They are good platforms. We will have vaccines if we have a worsening situation against bird flu. We will have better vaccines. We already have some vaccines that are developed against bird flu. The problem, though, is that with these platforms, it takes a really long time and a lot of resources to produce the vaccines. And ramping up production is something that could take months, even years. And if there were really a significant outbreak, we could be in a situation where we just don't have enough vaccine for all the people who are at risk. This is where the mRNA vaccine platform comes in. As we saw during COVID, it's possible to ramp up production quite substantially, very different from these other platforms that have existed before. And the contract that already existed with Moderna, it was hundreds of millions of dollars. And also, there were already initial promising results. So I guess it just does not, of course, it does not make sense to me as to why one would go about canceling this contract, except that you have to see this perhaps through the lens of Secretary Kennedy and his supporters, where there is such distrust of the mRNA vaccine that they are really willing to throw away the potential for us to save maybe millions of lives just based on their distrust of the mRNA platform, which of course is wrongheaded, it's unscientific, and we may never see the consequence of this because, knock on wood, we'll never have a bird flu outbreak that kills a lot of human beings. But if that does come to pass, we will look back at this moment and think, what have we done?
Yeah, it was a $766 million contract with the federal government, and it's been canceled. And it is really just very troubling and very puzzling as to why this particular platform, the mRNA vaccine platform, is you know, such a focal point of ire among Secretary Kennedy and the people around him. It just doesn't make any sense. You wrote about another thing that RFK Jr. has been very vocal about over the years, and that is seed oils. Is he right about those? He seems to say to suggest that they can be pretty dangerous, and we should avoid them. What do you think?
Well, this is another case where he is not entirely right, and actually is more wrong than right. And so let me explain. The problem with seed oils in general is not so much the seed oils themselves, but rather what they are used for. They tend to be products that are used in ultra-processed food, in things like chips. And so if you do end up consuming a lot of seed oil because you eat a lot of these foods, surely that is not good. That's not good for you. And by the way, the seed oils, by seed oils, we're referring to the derivatives of vegetable seeds, things like corn, canola oil, sunflower oil, grapeseed oil, et cetera. But if you look at actually the data around seed oil, at best they are equivocal. There are some studies in mice that have shown that components in seed oil could increase the rate of inflammation, which is associated with chronic illnesses like heart disease and cancer. But those types of results have not been replicated in humans. And so I think most nutritionists will argue that seed oils aren't really that bad on them by themselves, but rather it's what they're being used for. And I guess the other issue that we should consider too is, what is it that Kennedy and others and advocates are attempting to replace seed oils with? If you're replacing seed oils with extra virgin olive oil, which is not processed, that is actually a better choice for you because we know that extra virgin olive oil contains healthful benefits. So if that's what you're doing, switching from canola oil to extra virgin olive oil, probably that's a good idea. But if you're replacing it with saturated fat, with animal fats, with beef tallow, as we've heard Secretary Kennedy and chains like Steak and Shake decide to do, that's probably not the best idea because animal fats have their own problems due to high concentrations of saturated fat that we know raise cholesterol, that we know increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. And so I think this is another issue where the situation is nuanced, and distilling it to absolutely no seed oil, let's replace it with animal fat, probably not the best idea.
As we finish up, I do want to make sure that listeners are aware of a wonderful column you wrote about a woman named Joni Holofield, who runs an organization called Heart Smiles. I had Joni on the show a few months ago. We talked about it, the work that she does. But in terms of alleviating poverty and dealing with some of the inequities that, have long been a source of huge concern here in our city, Joni's doing some wonderful work addressing that. And this is a public health issue, isn't it? It's related.
That's right. We have to think about the social determinants of health, how issues like poverty and educational inequities and lack of housing directly translate into big differences when it comes to health outcomes, when it comes to life expectancy. And I happened to meet Joni at an event and was so captivated by her story that I wanted to write about the work that she was doing to reverse the cycle of poverty and hopelessness and trauma. She focuses on young people, and she has what I understand is two interventions. One part is career and leadership development. She has these youth come to her center after school. They get paid for their work. They get paid $15 an hour to essentially invest in themselves, in their own development, which I think is really powerful. And then the second part is youth-led mentorship, which involves pairing young people with people who are with those who are not much older than them. And I just think it's really such a great example of how everyone can make a difference, how we don't need to wait. Sometimes the problems that we face are so big that people don't know where to start. But Joni and Heart Smiles show that you can start from somewhere and really make a difference to the people that they serve.
Yeah, she's terrific. And it's great that you highlighted her in the Washington Post. We're out of time, but let me give you just a few seconds to answer a question from our good friend Tom in Mount Vernon, who's a regular listener. What's the distinction between regular measles and German measles? And is the vaccine regimen for either of them different?
Yes, a great question from Tom. These are two different viruses, and people need to be sure that they are vaccinated against both.
Dr. Lena Wen is a former health commissioner of Baltimore and a columnist for The Washington Post. Her latest book is Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Many thanks. We'll talk to you next month.
Thank you, Tom.
And up next, Christian Lane, the director of music at Emmanuel Church in Baltimore, previews a concert in honor of Pride Month. He'll join me after a quick break. But before we go to that break, each week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We get their names from a researcher named Ellen Worthing from the Baltimore Sun and from the Baltimore Police Department. We acknowledge those who have lost their lives and had their lives taken to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 55 people have been identified as victims of homicide in Baltimore. Brandon Naylor, age 38, was killed the week before last. Police have identified three of the four people who lost their lives last week. They are Tobias Cunningham, age 50, Devin Thompson, age 27, and Kirsten Washington. She was 31 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.